Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. You could say that Daryl Hammond is Saturday Night Live royalty. He's had a longer association with the show than any other performer as a cast member for 14 seasons from 1995 to 2009, and he's been the show's announcer since 2014. While his brilliant impressions of celebrities like Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Chris Matthews, and Sean Connery were becoming a hallmark of the show, off camera, he was suffering from the effects of childhood trauma at the hands of his parents, which resulted in a cycle of alcohol and drug abuse, self-injury, and hospitalization. That story is chronicled in a new documentary called Cracked Up, and I'm very pleased to welcome Daryl Hammond, along with the film's director, Michelle Ezrick, to our show now. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Daryl, you first reveal some of this history in your memoir, God, If You're Not Up There, I'm, and I'm going to use a euphemism for the word you used, I'm screwed. And it was subtitled Tales of Stand-Up, Saturday Night Live, and Other Mind-Altering Mayhem. Did you write it after you left Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, I wanted two things to be in play or not in play anymore. I didn't want to be on SNL anymore and sort of embarrass Lorne with all that. And then I also wanted my mother.
Embarrass him?
I didn't want him to be asked questions about this book while I was still there. And, you know, I thought it might complicate things while I was working there. And then I wanted the perpetrator of the book to have died. So both things happened and I was able to write it.
And then you turned it into a play.
Got turned into a play at La Jolla Playhouse, directed by Chris Ashley. Yeah, one-man show.
And it could have been made into a film by you, but you wound up working with Michelle on this documentary. Michelle, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, Daryl and I have been friends for years, and he was working on the play, and we were hanging out at his apartment, and he was saying how he was on a deadline. He had to finish a scene, and he didn't feel like typing. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to help out my pal, and I said, well, why don't I type, and you can just sit next to me and tell the stories. Would that help you finish the scene? And he said, yeah. And so he liked this idea and started this process, and but I started to hear the stories in a way, and many of them I had never heard before, that I wanted to tell the story. And then he said something that really blew my mind, which was, he said his doctor told him not to call this a mental illness, but to call it a mental injury. And that made me want to tell the story really based on that statement.
I wasn't sure whether to call it a tragicomedy or a comic tragedy. Because
That's a good question.
It was meant as a joke. But anyway, but this film could reach a lot more people than a play, obviously.
Well, that's what I told him. How many people could afford Broadway? And the play was absolutely brilliant. And Christopher Ashley's is brilliant. But a documentary is something that's accessible to everybody.
Now, I'm going to ask a lot of questions directed at Daryl, but Michelle, please jump in whenever.
I feel like that, you know, when it comes to this project, we have basically been completing one another's sentences about 5 years.
Well, keep on doing that, okay?
So
people will figure out that
I'll be referring
it's
to her.
You talking and not Daryl doing your voice.
Yeah.
The film begins, Daryl, at your childhood home in Wisteria Drive in Melbourne, Florida. Why'd you want to start there?
That's the director's question. That's okay. That's a Michelle question.
Well, we actually didn't start there. That was the last place we filmed. It was someplace that Daryl was interested in returning to. the house. And at the time, he started feeling a bit triggered by it, and his therapist said it wasn't a good idea to go. And so we waited about 4 more years, and he really wanted to go, and I was nervous about taking him there. And I said, if your therapist tells me it's okay, then, you know, we'll definitely go. And it turned out that it was a very healing experience for Daryl.
Yeah, I mean, we basically prepped to walk into that house for 4 years.
You needed that long time
me and,
to work it out.
And at least one doctor, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, prepped to walk into that house, and we looked at pictures of it. And I've been in therapy for things that happened to that house since I was 19, so that's another 90 years or so. I mean, it's a real long time. Mm-hmm. And it was strange to walk back in there and not feel almost a little bit victorious, like not triggered at all. Didn't really get triggered till a few days later, but my spirit was set to walk in there and not fall apart.
You say that you lived near the railroad tracks, and that as a child you used to go and sit on the tracks. Yeah. You were hoping the train would come by and hit you?
No, I don't know why I was sitting on the tracks. As I learned, I was teaching myself how to cry, because I noticed that my mother wouldn't hit me or anything if I was already crying. In other words, the pleasure of inflicting pain was removed. I would already be in pain, and so...
Do you ever find out why? I mean, your mother was almost a classic sadist. Had she been abused when she was a kid?
I think that's the crux of the whole show. I don't know, the Broadway play and the book is that, you know, monsters don't make themselves. And that was the therapy that this genius doctor who finally cracked the code in my head, you know, put me through, mm-hmm, was that she had to come from the same place and to try to feel a little sympathy for the devil, so to speak.
You say that you felt safe when the maid, Mertisa, was there, but lived in fear after she... Is it Mertis?
Mertis.
Mertis. But you lived in fear after she went home. What would happen?
Well, after she went... Well, it would get dark, and then my father would or would not come home, but then he would get there, and he'd be, I would say, mostly drinking and throwing things and breaking things. He had super bad PTSD from fighting Nazis, and my father,
which they used to call shell shock or something else. They didn't call it PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, once he became this warrior, you either become a warrior or you go crazy, and the people that become warriors have a really hard time not being a warrior. So there he was back in Melbourne, and thinking about the life he lost to, I'm sorry, I have a cold to your listeners. I'm not crying. but he had a thing about Nazis. And so he'd be in the house looking at pictures of them, throwing stuff, screaming, or sometimes he'd just wake up screaming at night. You know?
But to all appearances, you had a normal childhood. You played baseball. Your dad was the team's coach. Did people see you as the perfect all-American family?
Yeah. World's best mom, great dad. But see, nobody really looks too much farther than a series. Like, it's almost like a little checklist. The child doesn't have marks on him.
But you did have marks on you. You were hospitalized for internal injuries a number of times.
Only one time.
Oh, but your mother said you'd fallen off a bike?
I'd hit my... There were these... I forget what they call them now. They were different kind of handlebars for bikes, where the grips were raised. And so she told the doctor that that had caused me to have an accident. And then my stomach had actually gone down on the bars, which I think, you know, at that time, it was probably 1960. So I think he may or may not have been incredulous, but here was a family that filled out the moral checklist of the day. Twice in church every week, really up on your scriptures, really know how to quote the New Testament, coaching Little League, paying taxes, not committing crimes. Therefore, it's perfect. That's what I used to call the moral checklist. If you check out on all of those, in those days, you were basically unimpeachable. Does that make sense, Michelle?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever tell anyone what was going on?
No, because
we have more tissues.
Sorry, I'm going to use them all today. I had four shows in D.C. this weekend, and I'm still, and I was sick, so I'm not well yet. But I'm plugging along. Okay, what was that question?
You didn't tell anybody. Your mother told you better not.
You know, to me, people ask me what's the book about. I always, you know, there's so much stuff about SNL in there, but I always want to say it's about the basic standard contract between perpetrator and victim.
And Michelle, you shot some scenes with Daryl's childhood friend Larry Laskowski, mm-hmm. and he says he didn't notice anything was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell Larry, I thank him all the time, that he speaks for all of us who don't want to believe that these things can happen. And he didn't see it. And when I called him to do sort of the pre-interview on the telephone, I realized that he had never talked to Daryl. And he said he never wanted to read the book until he could really sit down and have a conversation with Daryl about it. And somehow, you know, the two of them didn't seem to find the time to do that. And then probably deep down didn't want to shatter these memories that Larry had, where they were over at each other's houses every day. They had beautiful memories of being on Little League together. And Larry loved Daryl's parents. And so they actually had the talk on camera for the first time in their lives, which was extraordinary.
Was that a relief?
I don't know. He needed it. He needed to ask. He needed to say. Most of us here think that a doctor in New York put that idea in your head. And, you know, I knew your mom and I knew your dad. And it just doesn't seem possible to me.
Well, he did actually. It was closure for Larry. He did, at the end of their conversation, he did say that after he read in the paper about the abuse, he raced over to their house, to Daryl's parents' house, and he said that the way his mother was acting and the way the father was acting, he knew deep in his heart it was true, but he needed to hear from his friend that it was true.
But he needed a better explanation. You know, he needed the explanation of a genius doctor who would say that even children from bad homes don't make up stories about their parents mm-hmm. that would put them in prison. Mm-hmm. And secondly, when you take a razor blade to yourself and open and cut into your flesh, by definition, you're risking your own life. And to me, this is the most cogent.
And you'd become a cutter.
Yeah, I was a cutter, but, you know, no, when I was told, you know, because I remember leaving the hospital saying to the doctor, what if I made this up? Mm. How do you know I didn't just make this whole thing up? He said, no living organism, because if you cut into your flesh, you don't know what you're cutting. So by definition, you're risking your own life. And his view was no living organism can risk its own life unless it's to save it. So that was about staying alive, you know.
What did the cutting do? Does it? Is there a reassuring aspect to it?
Well,
a calming aspect?
There's a couple of things. And in my case, it was creating a more manageable crisis than the one going on in my head. But it was also sort of a reenactment of molestation as well, you know. I mean,
because you had blocked it out in many other ways.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Daryl Hammond and Michelle Ezrick about a film called Cracked Up. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. Daryl, when did you realize that you were a natural comic? I mean, this is not the sort of thing that I would associate with somebody who would be funny. Were you funny when you were a kid?
I guess I kind of was. I mean, you know, you learn techniques to survive, and one was make sure I could cry when I needed to, because, you know, if there's no pleasure in hurting someone that's already hurt.
So that was actually a protective thing.
Yeah, that was to stop, to avoid being hit or a number of other things. But my mother delighted when, you know, she had this bizarre ability to talk like the neighbors. She had this transformative quality. And so we would listen to this record called A Christmas Carol. And if I could get her engaged in that record, and we would do the voices together. And the next thing you know, I was discovering I could do it too. I could talk like other people too. And I'll tell you, when you're 8 or 9, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and you can talk like Porky Pig, you know, you're a big man on campus. You know, you that's instant validation no matter where you go, no matter what social circle you're in.
and you say that you saw each of the voices as a different color. For example, Popeye was blue, Daffy Duck was purple. Isn't that a form of synesthesia?
It is synesthesia. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely synesthesia.
But you only had it with voices, not with other sounds or music?
I suppose I did, but I never attached a color to anything that I didn't want to learn. You know, I mean, if I was learning how to do something, I would try to attach it.
Yeah, like all his scripts are different colors, and that's how he started learning in school.
So you had to figure like at SNL, and I've 1,000 on-camera appearances. There's 1,000 scripts. They were all marked with different colors.
And you did something like 105 voices or something like that. You could run out of colors very quickly.
I think I did 137 on air and learned another 500 off air. But you do run out of colors. But, I mean, that's why Ted Koppel and Dick Cheney are the same color.
I see.
Right? Mm-hmm. And
I'm not sure which one of them would be more insulted.
I don't know. I told Dick Durbin he was green. I don't think he liked that too much. I was like, Pee Wee Herman's green. Yeah.
You went to University of Florida as a theater major.
Yeah.
And then you moved to New York. Did you come here because you were looking to establish a career, or were you escaping?
I wanted to be in front of people. As a ball player, you get applause. I wanted more.
And you were a good ball player?
Up until a point. Uh-huh. You know, up until that point where your talent just doesn't take you any. Mm-hmm. My talent took me as far as it could, which was junior college, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you started doing stand-up in comedy clubs, and that's where you were discovered?
Discovered.
Well, did Lorne Michaels actually find you in a comedy club?
I think he did. I mean, the sequence was... on 50th Street, I was working in a catering hall, and I would do impressions at the bar. So my first public performance was at the Skyline Motor Inn. And then when I got really good, I started doing sets at Caroline's on 50th and Broadway, and that's where I got discovered.
Well, Caroline's was a good club to be discovered in.
Yeah, but I had to...
They must have thought you were good, otherwise they wouldn't have let you there.
I had to get good before they would put me on.
Uh-huh. And were you doing impressions at the time?
At that time, I was only doing one impression. I was doing Clinton. Mm-hmm. Because when I first got to New York, I tried to get into the comedy clubs. I turned down by every single one of them, including Caroline's, because I did impressions. Mm-hmm. So that took me another 2 years to get 15 minutes of decent stand-up material that didn't have impressions in it. And then, I threw the one Clinton in because it was just too irresistible.
And I would think that that would have been irresistible for Saturday Night Live, which would have wanted to have somebody to be able to do Clinton.
SNL had I'd been turned down, not turned down like, hey, we're not interested, just it's not a good time. Mm-hmm. But I had been rejected twice. Phil Hartman was going to retire. They were looking for a Clinton, you know?
You became a regular cast member in 1995. At the time, was that considered the pinnacle of success in the comedy world?
You can't be far from it.
Well, you were 39 years old already, yeah, so...
I was already in elder care.
But, yeah, it's rare for somebody of your age to join.
Yeah, that's a show for 20-somethings and early 20-somethings.
So the other cast members look upon you as some old guy?
Probably, but they didn't show it. My head was, listen, when I was 27, I decided I wanted to get good enough to get hired by them no matter what. And that's a childish thing to think, you know? Mm-hmm. That's magical thinking. But I worked at it, and it actually came true.
What color was Bill Clinton's voice?
Orange and a little yellow.
Do you keep count of how many times you've played him?
No.
You have appeared with him. Are the people you impersonate generally amused by how you've done
They act amused. I don't know how amused they are. but they do act like it. Chaney was the best audience.
Really?
Chaney, yeah. I had six times I sort of got together with him, a couple of times at the vice president's mansion, and then there were other times just for shaking hands and pleasantries is all. But he'd pound the desk.
And didn't matter what your politics were, whether how you approached a politician?
I suppose if I'd been extreme left, you know, I probably wouldn't have been granted an audience. But the way I always approached these guys, because my father was a soldier, the way I approached these guys was, I'm going to say something good about them before I insult them.
I wonder how Chaney's reacting to the way he's being portrayed in this new movie.
I haven't seen the new movie. Tell me about it.
I haven't seen it either, but just the little clips that you see on television, he really looks like him.
He's fabulous. Yeah. I saw the clips. Yeah. It's crazy good. And why won't he play me in my play?
We learn in the film that throughout your life, people have insisted on asking you to do your Clinton impression for them at moments when you are actually trying to have a more genuine interaction. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to do Clinton on this show. But you say that there was a time when you loved it when your mother asked you to do an impression. Do you remember when being asked to do something like that became a negative?
There were times when I would go out with women back in the day, and I thought they were...
Before you got married.
Yeah, well, you know, I thought they would be interested in me, but they kind of weren't. They were interested in Bill.
Really?
So, oh, God.
They thought,
from the colonoscopy to the foot fetishes to, people offering to flash you, sure.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, right?
So it was an adventure of a sort, even if
it
didn't end the way you might have wanted.
I think that, you know, the thing about this film was, and Michelle sort of pointed this out to me recently, the big deal about it was, you know, I think the hallelujah chorus moment comes for any survivor when you realize you're as powerful as your perpetrator. Hmm. You have just as much or more power. And then you want to break the contract. And that's, for me, was sort of what the film... But I had never understood it as well as when she expressed it recently.
Did you get feedback from your family as you were becoming famous? Were they proud of you?
They acted proud. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when I was on Saturday Night Live, I believe I was 46 years old, and Jamie Gangel from NBC News did a documentary, did a 10-minute feature on the Today Show about me and interviewed my mother and said it was one of the most harrowing experiences she's had in a good long while. You know,
she found it harrowing, huh?
That Jamie Gangel. When she sort of confronted, you know, when you confront perps with, hey, you're a perp. Do you understand you're a perp? Mm. I mean, you're not a nice person or even a good, you know, you're a perp. Get it? When she sort of confronted her that I was going through therapy for child abuse, and yet all I had done was grow up in her home. Did she want to comment on that? Yeah, that was something.
You bear a resemblance to Clinton. So was doing Al Gore more difficult? Because... there's not that immediate recognition factor in the physically.
I try not to rely on the physical appearance thing, but there have been times I relied on it too much, so.
Well, there was no way you could do Sean Connery without putting on all sorts of makeup.
No, I'd have to be made up for Mr. Connery.
Wasn't your portrayal of Gore in the presidential debate with George Bush so accurate that his staff forced him to watch it?
Yes. That's
so to avoid doing the things that he was doing wrong?
It's either that or because I'd picked three hand gestures. Uh-huh. You know, I had picked, it seemed to me that he had a number of coaches over the years and I was able to see coaching techniques. And I picked out like one coach and I just did that guy. So I think they were, I have no idea, but.
So did you have a formula for studying the subjects of your impressions? Obviously, you watched film of them. What about getting the voice and down the way you just
well,
set
remember
an
these were all
ability.
Learned on the clock at SNL, so there's not a lot of time. Get as much material as you can get. When you're looking at the person, pray that you've done something, someone similar in your life. That helped pick out two or three hand gestures and find out where they're from, how long they, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff you can pull off in an hour.
The year before the Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary special in 2014, you took over the only other, for the only other announcer that Saturday Night Live had ever had, Don Pardo. He died that year at the age of 96. So he was doing the announcing at 96?
Yeah.
He'd been this, well, he had a 70-year broadcasting career. But didn't you fill in with him over the years if he wasn't well?
Yeah.
You did Don Pardo, too?
Yes, I did. I did the Elle McPherson show. I did the whole show, and there was one other show that I did.
What was it like doing the Saturday Night Live opening with your own voice for the first time?
Well, I don't think it is my own voice. I think we made up a voice. You know, I went to New York, and I was living in New Orleans at the time, and I flew to New York, and I worked out in the studio with the producer Steve Higgins and Lauren, and we invented a voice that sort of was an homage to Don Pardo, because we weren't going to replace him. We were going to do an homage to him. So I think when you hear me do the montage, you will hear there are usually three or four vowels in the montage where I do his voice in the vowels, because a person's voice only appears in the vowels, not in the consonants.
Huh.
That's nerd stuff.
Well,
all of our consonants are the same. It's just the vowels where we distinguish ourselves.
And that's true about regional accents as well. Sometimes
that's where you
when I listen to a southern accent, I think, that vowel sound is a lot more complex than it need to be. Why don't they just simply say O or I instead of, I don't know. You do, well, you do it
I
better.
I mean, first question I'm going to ask the heavenly maker when I see him. Can we talk about these diphthongal changes,
vowels,
please? And the
I wonder if it happens in other languages.
What?
I wonder if it happens in other languages.
Well, I used to, as a kid, my father bought me a reel-to-reel and a splicing kit, and I would, you know how you move the tape? Mm-hmm. I would literally cut the consonants out and just keep the vowels, you know. Again, nerd stuff, but ended up making a living at it.
Michelle, is that how you got started in filmmaking, nerd stuff?
Exactly.
But you were, how long ago was that?
That I got started in filmmaking? Yeah. Well, my first film was about Wavy Gravy, and it started in 1999.
A BAI connection.
A BAI connection, yes. Bob Fass.
Uh-huh. And then?
And this was my second film.
Ah. And it doesn't look like a second film. It really is very effective. Before we get back to Daryl's story, how can people see it?
Well, they should go to crackedupmovie.com, www.crackedupmovie.com, and they should sign up to our sign-up list for updates on the film. And as soon as we have a release date, we will email everybody.
Is it going to be in theaters, or is it going to be on TV, or did they tell you, have you decided yet?
It's all being worked out now.
Really? By folks who know how to do it?
It's all being worked out, yes.
But we're discussing it today on Leonard Lopate at Large. Did Sean Connery ever give you a hard time about portraying him as a homophobic bully who could read barely at the third grade level?
No. I heard he was on The Tonight Show with Leno and said he really liked it. He said, he does me better than me, which is, you know, pretty classic coming from Sir Connery.
You also did Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and many people feel that white people should never imitate a black person because of all of the racist legacy of blackface performance all the way up to the 1930s. But your performance is so accurate.
Why do you suppose people never objected? I mean, I did Jesse Jackson at the Apollo Theater one day live. I think maybe they could see I wasn't just fooling around. I mean, I'd really been studying this stuff for a long, long time.
And he's not wearing blackface.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So it was really just the voice and people understood.
And I would do the physical mannerisms too. But again, with Jesse Jackson, as with Chaney, I all of the characters that I played, I always said something nice about them before I made fun of them. I learned, because my hero was Richard Pryor, and that's what he did. So that's what I did.
Now, Richard Pryor didn't do voices, but he was
good voices.
He was still one of the funniest people that ever lived. And a troubled life.
Yeah, but you know, Pryor could go in front of a wide audience and do what I've not seen comics do, and that is educate the person as well as making them laugh. And part of it was that he let them know he respected them as humans, and that behavior was what he was actually making fun of, I think.
And he came out of Lenny Bruce. Had you seen Lenny Bruce perform as well?
I never have, not until Miss Maisel.
Yeah, well,
and he's quite good, isn't he?
Yeah, but the real Lenny Bruce.
No, I never did.
As we see in the film, you were doing a lot of destructive things behind the scenes when you were at Saturday Night Live. Alcohol, drugs, even, as we said earlier, cutting yourself right before you went on the air?
Only one time.
How did that affect your performances on the show? Did the cutting... I mean...
That time I needed to do it because I was just flipping out in my head. I was having some sort of flashback or something, and it was the Gore presidential debate, the first one of 2000, so I just made a little incision, and that released the... Suddenly I had a crisis more manageable than the one going on in my head. And it freed me up to go out there and do the debate. But no, I only did that one time.
But then once you were taken to the hospital directly from the studios.
Right, but not before a show.
Uh-huh. You were hospitalized several times before that?
God, who can count?
Now, you've received all sorts of diagnoses ranging from schizophrenia to bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, even multiple personalities. Were you getting different diagnoses from different doctors?
Yeah. I mean, I think by the time, you know, the doctor that Marcel portrays in the film.
The one who actually figures it all out.
In the book and the play, sort of the star of my show, of my life, if that were a show. By the time I got to him, I'd seen, you know, almost 40 doctors, and all of them had sort of thrown their hands up in despair. You know, we were just coming out of an era where if you felt fear for no reason, or you felt sad for no reason, or you felt pain for no reason, nothing really going on, no life event to make you feel bad, but you still feel scared, they just said you were bipolar. Mm-hmm. Now we know it's complex PTSD.
Carrie Fisher told me she hated the phrase bipolar. She preferred manic depressive. She said bipolar sounds like a confused bear, sexually confused bear.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they had, and they would give you lithium.
But PTSD was just becoming known, and it makes real sense considering what you went through
as a kid. What's really interesting to note is that you cannot see mental illness in the brain. Mm-hmm. You can see trauma in the brain. And it really comes from...
You can see it with an MRI?
You can see it with something called brain mapping.
Oh.
And you can actually see neglect. You can actually see physical abuse. You can see different types of trauma in the brain where mental illness is a good guesstimation. And that's why the fact that this, you know, the Dr. Cotby who we're talking about told Daryl, this is not a mental illness. What you have is a mental injury. That, you know, everybody who suffers from trauma are suffering from a biological condition, and there's no shame to this. There's no.
But you know, I don't know. I never really realized until our recent work that you could look at someone's brain on a computer screen and tell you if that person. Mm-hmm. Was suffering from trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bessel van der Kolk, the doctor, one of the great trauma doctors of our time as well as Dr. Cotby, he wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score, and he's featured in the film. And he showed me all the different types of trauma in the brain.
I mean, you know, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, so as a 7-year-old, you could have taken me to the doctor that day, and he could have run that as part of his pediatric
Exactly.
You know, program.
Exactly.
And treating a child, we're going to just do a complete pediatric checkup here.
Yes, and it is a medical issue.
And we would see trauma, and then the guy would turn to him and go, to my mom and go, I don't think he hit himself on a bike, did he? Now, why don't you tell me what really happened?
Yeah. And the, because
amazing. Think of that.
Well, Daryl and I recently went to Washington, D.C., and we met with Congress to help, and we helped add 9 provisions for trauma-informed care into the opioid support bill, which actually got passed into law in October, because there's a group of senators and congresspeople who understand that this is a biological issue.
And do you see this film as a way to help other people who have experienced childhood trauma? Also to convince people in Congress and the like that this is a more serious problem. This is one of those real hidden problems in our society.
For Daryl and I, we feel like we're holding a key. And we just want to share the key with everybody. Last week, we were on another show, and just by telling our story, I got an email through the website that a woman said, I was about to end my life until I heard you and Daryl talking on this show. And I decided not to because I felt so validated. You validated my story, my suffering. And I mean, there's really nothing, I mean, there's no words. There's nothing better for that. And we knew that by telling his story, sometimes I tell my story, but this film was going to help a lot of people. And it's to encourage people to tell the truth and that there's no shame. As Daryl says, you know, if I got hit by a car, I wouldn't be ashamed. If I broke my leg, I wouldn't be ashamed.
Well, he wasn't responsible for his mother's craziness.
That's
but
what we're saying.
What is the website? So in case people listening to this show also are inspired.
The website is crackedupmovie.com.
Now, Daryl, Saturday Night Live had other troubled people before you, John Belushi, Chris Farley. So did they just understand that you were one of those kinds of people?
I suppose they did, but I mean, you know, if you understand there were, I mean, I don't claim to know Lorne Michaels well, but I know enough about him in the workplace.
We see a very different Lorne Michaels in this film than mm-hmm. we're used to seeing.
Very compassionate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the same way that Nick Saban, an Alabama football coach, might be. I mean, in the same way. Mm-hmm. Because he had the way he talked to me privately, not often. I understood that we had an agreement, and that was if I couldn't hit a home run, you know, if I couldn't do good, if I couldn't give a good performance, he was going to pull me off the air. So it went like that. But, I mean, I was able to not – I was able to keep it together for game day, you know.
Mm-hmm. But were you experiencing flashbacks at this time?
Yeah.
And what were they like? I mean, and they must have been debilitating, but did they also just stop you in your tracks?
You know, let's go back. I would go to the doctor, and he would say, well, you're manic depressive. You've got to be a bipolar or unipolar. One of the polars, you're a polar. You're one of these. But now we find out you have the limbic nervous system and something called limbic rage and disorder and limbic fear disorder, and people with complex PTSD, you're going to feel it just keeps trying to bring those memories to light. If you've never addressed the day you got stabbed, the day you got hit with a hammer, the day you got left on a park, the day you got electrocuted, the day you got your hand slammed in doors, if you've never addressed that.
Or a knife in your tongue.
And a knife in your tongue. If you haven't addressed it, Mother Nature will force you to address it. She's going to keep bringing you back there until it's the Martin Luther King phrase. You want to be moved to tears? Truth crushed to earth will rise again.
And
that's
then,
that.
And then I imagine getting married and having a daughter.
Can I jump in?
Being a parent, of course.
Can I just jump into the book? Because I think it's really important for the listeners. You don't have to have the same story as Daryl to have trauma. What qualifies you is if a child's living in fight or flight, okay? And that could be from a horrific divorce. It could be from witnessing domestic violence every day. It could be from poverty. It could be from a suicide. It could be from, but it's repeated when the cortisol levels are high and it's affecting your adrenal glands in a developing brain in a child, and this is happening repeatedly. And one of the best examples is like if you're in the woods and you are confronted by a bear, and your adrenals go off and your heart's pumping and your cortisol levels, your hormone levels are going crazy. If your parent is the bear and this is happening to your system as a child every day, that is what rewires your brain. That's what changes the architecture in the brain, and that's what creates ill health 20, 30, 40, 50 years downstream. So when people are having this dis-ease in their bodies, you know, later in life, and they're suffering from anxiety or depression, or it could be heart disease or cancer, because trauma gets lodged in the body, and it can last for a lifetime.
Part of the whole thing is that it can be lodged in the body and cause actual physical illness.
But then you say memories are triggered by things. I was going to say you got married, had a daughter, and after your daughter was born, your mother called and offered to take the child for a while so that you could have a break. That must have.
Yeah.
Did that bring back bad memories?
Well, the sequence was when I saw or held her in my arms the first time, and I had to ask the question. It's a natural question. What would you have to do to this perfect creature to turn her into me? And then I began to realize something must have happened to me. And a short time after that, I met my first trauma doctor who confirmed that. But the main thing was I was like, what did something? You know, I remember my hands being slammed in doors, but I literally thought I did that. Mm-hmm. I literally thought I took the cover off the light socket. I literally thought I did that.
So to make it easier to bear it?
It's better than that, than believing your mom don't love you, mm-hmm. which is, you know, if you're a kid, you might as well just shoot me.
Yeah, it's not even a conscious thing like I'm going to believe this. It's more that it's just so ingrained that my parent or the significant person in my life that's caring for me would do this. It's so hard to believe that a child will just blame themselves.
Mm-hmm. That's what
Daryl's doctor Coppi says. The worst part about trauma is that the victim blames themselves.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Michelle Esrick, director of a film called Cracked Up, and with its subject, Daryl Hammond. This is Leonard Lopin at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM in New York. So what happened when your mother, grandparents make that offer all the time. What did you tell your mother?
I just realized I have a short sleeve shirt on. I never wear a short sleeve shirt. Say that again.
When your mother made the offer, as grandparents do all the time.
Then I knew it was her.
Uh-huh. And then you had to say no, Mom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's when it started getting really rough. Because, you know, Michelle used this phrase once when we were working together that my soul always knew, but my brain just wasn't going to accept it. Some deep part of me knew that the worst possible scenario, the worst possible thing had occurred, the worst thing that could happen to a child had happened, and that I wasn't this way because of some enzyme or lack of enzymes, you know? So when I heard that, I was like, oh, now I know.
Have you ever linked the fact that you can be very funny with all of these terrible things in your past?
No.
Do you think being funny was an escape or?
It certainly, I used it as an escape.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, just, you know.
And becoming other people by coming up with other voices? Not being yourself?
You know, this is a weird story. You can figure this one out on your own. But to me, when I was a little kid, I remember distinctly thinking that if I could, because I, you know, another reason why I would want to do this film is I want anyone that's still alive that knew my family to hear this, to understand that this was going on in a home near you. And I began to believe that if I could become like my mother and her friends, well, then I don't have an enemy. I've just became them, you know? That was part of it.
So did you impersonate your mother as well?
No. But I learned her value system, and I learned what turned her on, and I learned what made her speak at length, the stuff she liked to pontificate on, which was usually the Bible.
And, you know, it just seems so odd that somebody who was strong, so religious, could be so awful to her.
Monsters
job.
Hide in the light, brah. The Prince of Darkness is a gentleman.
And also, you know, Daryl also, the house was, it was primed for trauma for Daryl and his sister. And it wasn't just his mother. It was his father had PTSD from World War II.
Yeah, but okay. He wasn't hitting.
No, he never
but,
hit
but
me.
You don't have to hit, okay? So when Daryl was sleeping, his father was punching holes in doors. Yeah. The talk about fight or flight, right? When that would wake him up.
Broken window.
Broken windows. If you're living with somebody who has PTSD, who has that kind of mental condition, that creates the trauma as well.
And were you surprised when you discovered that, like,
we're
your father?
We're going to do a speaking thing together. We're going to do a circuit speaker thing because I think we really complement each other. I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you learned that you also had PTSD,
yeah.
did that make some of your father's actions make more sense to you?
I 1,000%. And the fact that my father said on his deathbed this... You know, I was doing SNL the night before, and then I flew down to Florida the next day where he was in hospice, and I got there, and he had his war medals on his chest, and he explained what he'd won each medal for, and then to apologize for being a bad father. And his final words were, I let my anger be more important to me than my children.
Wow.
Mm. That's deep. That's a soldier.
And it's really what they're calling it for children is not PTSD. It's really it's called toxic stress. Every child grows up yeah. with toxic stress, but with stress, not toxic stress. Excuse me, but it becomes toxic stress when it's that repeated fight or flight situation.
And you say that everything changed or became clearer after you went to a hospital in upstate New York that specializes in childhood trauma, and one of your doctors told you that you were not suffering from mental injury, yeah. that you were suffering from mental injury, not mental illness. That also meant that you didn't have to take drugs anymore.
Oh, let me go back. It released me from the stigma that society had put on me that I had something to do with this, that somehow I had something to do with the way I was acting. So that's part of it. What about the drugs?
Well, you had been taking all different drugs to treat all the different conditions, and turned out it was PTSD.
Right. I mean, you can take stuff. I mean, you can take Wellbutrin. There's stuff you can take. You're just not going to take lithium, you know, that's going to put 40 pounds on you or what's the one? Are those things they give you for schizophrenia, just really awful.
But you were relying more on therapy at this point because things were opening up to you.
I didn't rely more on therapy until the doctor correctly diagnosed what was wrong with me, and then I did.
Well, there's many modalities that treat and heal trauma that don't have to do with medication, but that doesn't mean to say we're not saying that that there isn't a place for medication.
Absolutely.
For trauma
Lamictal's
survivors.
Great.
Gabapentin,
two of them. High marks. Sorry, Michelle.
So.
Now both of your parents are deceased.
Yeah.
Did you come to some kind of peace with them before they died?
My dad, not my ma. My ma, no.
And now you've become, as you said, an activist in the field. Do you speak before health organizations?
I do. I tell the story, but I think I really felt like I was arriving where I wanted to arrive when Michelle and I were in Dick Durbin's office last month. Then I was like, wow, we're getting close. We're getting close, you know, and I would tell them, if you guys want me to speak somewhere, I'll speak at a fundraiser or something like that to raise money, because we also met with the National Children's Alliance in D.C., and they're doing incredible stuff like mm-hmm. Michelle is talking about. Mm-hmm. You know what it is? It makes me – I don't know, Michelle, you know me better than anyone. It's almost like you like to think that it didn't happen for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we met with the National Foundation for Suicide Prevention. We met with Elizabeth Warren and many other great people who are, you know, fighting to help us all become trauma informed and change policy. Because this really is, I mean, when we go to the doctor's office and we have to fill out all the history, there needs to be a question about what happened.
And when you say we fill it out,
when we go to the doctor's office, there's a patient, there's a questionnaire, and we need to add the questionnaire, which actually comes from the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, ACEs, that has 10 questions. And those 10 questions, so if you answer four or more, it lets you know what the risks are. If you have six adverse childhood experiences in your background, you're significantly more at risk for suicide and for other things that Daryl's been through.
I don't want to give the listeners the impression that this is a depressing film. It's an inspiring film.
Thank you. And there are a lot of laughs because Daryl's a comic genius. So I very carefully and very intentionally weaved the comedy and the tragedy together in a way that has a nice balance. So it makes the story tolerable. And it is an inspiring story because we know how to treat trauma now. And so that's really exciting. And Daryl does yoga in the movie, mindful meditation, and which is one of the main modalities with many, 400 papers of research on how meditation and yoga can heal trauma in the brain. It can actually heal trauma gene.
And Congress passed the Trauma-Informed Care for Children and Families Act and the Opioid Crisis Response Act, to some degree because of what they heard from you?
Well, that's what they were saying around the Hill.
You've got the Republicans and Democrats to agree on something?
I don't know that they agreed on maybe a little bit.
Well, they did. I mean, it is a bipartisan issue.
Bill.
And we met with both Republicans and Democrats, and they loved the film, and they... Basically, we were there to support them. They're already working on the issue. They've been working on it for some time. So whatever we can do to help change more policy and create a trauma-informed system, that's what we want to do.
Do you miss doing stand-up?
I still do it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We do, yeah.
I'd imagine Caroline's would invite you back anytime you wanted.
Oh, Caroline's a good place. I'd go back.
He still does a lot of stand-up.
I do stand-up about once a month.
Mm-hmm. And do you know where you're going to be doing it next?
Cayman Islands. So far we have the Cayman Islands. That's all we have next year.
Well, thank you both so much for being on our show. We've been talking about a new documentary called Cracked Up with its subject, Daryl Hammond, and its director, Michelle Ezrick.
Thank you. And please do go to our website.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Daryl Hammond and Michelle Ezrick, to today's segment producers Barbara Kahn and Jesse Lent, who was also at the audio controls, to Kevin O'Donohue, Nassim, and Alex Lopez of the Positive Mind Center for granting us access to their first-rate studio facilities here. And to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.